farming, be it industrial, an organic CSA, or the backyard garden, is dependent on seeds. People have bred plant varieties since time immemorial. Each variety is known as a cultivar, and in 1900 there were untold thousands of cultivars in use. The oil age brought mechanized farming and demanded standardization. Cultivars were chosen to be uniform in size, ripen at a predictable time, and ship well. After World War II, surplus munitions factories were set to making fertilizer from ammonium nitrate instead of explosives. Cultivar reduction accelerated as breeders chose plants for their positive response to nitrogen fertilizer. By 1970, the result was a 95% reduction in the number of cultivars in use. Alarmed, agronomists held a series of conferences, including at Washington State University and one at Central Washington University, where I recorded many of the proceedings in 1974. In the early 1980s, a Supreme Court patent ruling made legal the patenting of life forms. That ruling set off a land rush of consolidation in the seed business, as hybrid cultivars could now be intellectual property. That one court ruling made possible the genetics industry we know today and enabled the GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, such as corn and soybeans. Since 1974, an affiliation of seed banks and independent seed companies has grown up to fill the void and maintain heirloom cultivars. Abundant Life Seeds in Port Townsend, Washington, owes its origins to that 1974 conference. Perhaps the largest of these companies, Seed Savers Exchange of Decorah, Iowa, was founded in 1975. Seeds of Change was co-founded by the subject of today's program, Alan Capular, in 1989. He served as research director until his retirement in 2000. Alan now runs Peace Seeds of Corvallis, Oregon.
Now, I was a molecular biologist. I was raised as a first world scientist. I used to publish in Nature and Proceedings of the National Academy, and ended up working collecting seeds and developing seed companies.
Alan's concern about the ecological impacts of GMOs is obvious.
It's transgenic. It's a new kind of genetic phenomenon that's being used to develop new kinds of food and pharmaceutical plants. And their interaction with the rest of the organisms on the world, that's the issue. That's the controversy about genetically modified organisms.
As transgenetic stuff happens, as we enter this age of the chimera, the Egyptian sphinx was a chimera, a mixture of organisms. It had a beak like a bird, like a hawk or an eagle. It had arms like a lion. It was a mythical beast. Well, we're making mythical beasts by taking a piece of a bacterium and a piece of a virus and sticking it in a plant. Right now, we're taking and mixing stuff that's been separated and isolated for millions and billions of years without even paying attention to the potential consequence. With the controversy involved genetically engineered foods, we thought, well, we ought to look around the world, see if there aren't a bunch of other interesting crops and vegetables that we could be growing, particularly here in the Pacific Northwest, Cascadia bioregion, that aren't genetically engineered and that have been grown by people for hundreds or thousands or ten thousands of years and are safe, nutritious, and we don't know about them. And amazingly enough, in the Andes, there's a whole host of these kind of crops. They grow wonderfully in the Pacific Northwest, just like quinoa, the grain that's grown by the Peruvians and Bolivians, and amaranth, which they also grew, and potatoes and peppers, winter squash, all which come from the Andes.
We're now standing in what looks like a canning cellar, except that the canning jars and gallon jars are full of seeds. We have yellow corn and what looks like red corn. We have beans. We have Ziploc bags of every description on the walls. What have we? Oh, we've got...
These are daisies. This is just a box full of different accessions of sunflowers. And there's maybe 200 packs of different kinds of sunflowers. And there's about 2,000 kinds of daisies sitting in this. So all the bins are filled either with this year's seeds or last year's. This is just new marigold.
Why are you doing this? Why are all these seeds in this room? You can't plant and grow all the stuff yourself.
There are many levels. One, it provides seeds for anyone who comes by who might be interested. I have people come by and say, you have this? And if I have it, they have it. So it allows more access to interesting diversity.
So these are native species that people have domesticated over millennia.
Tested out by life and death.
How many of the crops do American agriculturists grow?
What's the most popular backyard gardener crop? It's tomatoes. What's second? Corn. After that, it sort of falls off. People grow potatoes. People grow another 35 different kinds. I didn't know about tomatoes and how they breed. I saved the seeds and planted them. Then I started growing 100 kinds of tomatoes. I did it with lettuce and basil and peppers. And every crop has that depth of diversity and variety, actually. And then once you've looked over most of the food plants, you say, well, where'd the food plants come from? Do they come from a flying saucer? Or do they come from the native species that have been growing on the planet? One of the issues is, if human beings don't use it, are we going to wipe it off the planet Earth? The human use doctrine means that predominantly everything we use, we'll care about and take care of to a limited degree, and everything else we sort of say doesn't matter. Well, that's not a particularly enlightened view about the web of life that holds it all together.
So your seeds here in this room and others like you are an archive of the heritage for the future to maintain the biodiversity.
That's why we started collecting seeds.
For KBCS, this is Tom Allen.